Today on Doomed! Her Royal Majesty finally got him, folks. God save the Queen. This week, one of the OG conspiracy theorists, Lyndon LaRouche, passed away. I guess you can say, when you mess with the Queen, you best not miss? I don't know. Anyway, on the show today, we have Jay, an activist whose sibling is a Lyndon LaRouche follower. And we're going to talk with him basically to find out, now that the cult leader's dead, what happens to the cult? Jay, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Absolutely my pleasure.
Same.
Now, Jay, give me a little bit basically about how you got into this whole, what do they go by again? Like LaRouches or something like that? That's what their nickname is or something like that?
That is what they're colloquially named by mostly outsiders, yeah.
Right. They don't call themselves that, right? Yeah.
Right, yeah. There's a few nicknames out there that I'll avoid using. But how I became aware of it, did you say?
Yeah, like how did you sort of, you know, how did Jay enter the world of Lyndon LaRouche?
Well, like you said, my sibling, who I was living with at the time, basically, long story short, started to show very distinct and drastic changes in their personality, their interests, their beliefs, I would say. And I was sort of mystified at first. Many of my family members were also mystified at first where this was coming from. And time went on and they were going, you know, away for weekends and not really being sort of cagey about what was going on. And they were saying things like they were very into jazz music, and then suddenly jazz music became this thing that was not only silly and bad, but downright evil. And hearing a lot of things.
I get that.
Yeah. You know, who can account for taste? But when you start telling people that the music they listen to is satanic and all of this, we can get into that. But basically, all of these changes were happening, and I made the regrettable choice to invade my loved one's privacy. And I discovered the name Lyndon LaRouche, looked it up. It was in 2009, right at the height of the Obamacare debate, and front and center on the website, I see the big picture of Obama with a Hitler mustache, and my brain hit the ceiling. And I look from there, you know, the internet is a great resource, now for finding out about groups like this, and, you know, saw all about the history, the fraud trials, the anti-Semitism, the racism, the homophobia, all of this, all of the wealth of allegations that are out there, covered pretty well on the Wikipedia page, and the edit notes of the Wikipedia page are fascinating to look into, because you can see how the group has over the years tried to edit it and tried to take out the critical information and been shut down. And yeah, that was my entree into this world.
Right. Now, you know, would you say it's fair? Like, well, let's actually jump back. But first, let me just mention how, you know, I guess it's fair to say that whole Obama with the Hitler mustache time period for the LaRouche movement was, I guess, his big revival, his comeback. It's when he sort of reemerged on the scene, you could say.
Yes and no. They did get a lot of publicity out of that. Barney Frank had that moment with one of the LaRouche followers at a town hall that he did that year, where he said something to the effect of having a conversation with you is like trying to talk to a dining room table. I have no interest in doing it. You're standing there with a picture of the president, his face to face to look like Hitler, blah blah blah. And he actually had to debate her. Rachel Brown is her name. A couple of years later, when she ran against him for his seat, and they debated on like some public access thing in Massachusetts, and it's interesting.
It's something to, is it a recommend? Should I, like, you know, after
I
we,
mean, it's one of the deep cuts. If
all
you're
right.
like you gotta it's gotta you gotta be a devotee to maybe have it hold your attention.
Maybe instead of watching finishing up the Ted Bundy tapes on Netflix after we jump off this episode, I'll pull up one of those deep cuts.
It's funny you should say about the Ted Bundy tapes, because I identified with one of the prosecutors in that when he said that I'm ashamed to admit that I'm elated he's gone.
Wow. Oh, now let's jump back, actually. We're already way ahead. So, you know, I made some comments in the beginning in the intro about, you know, the Queen and, you know, the you know, Queen Elizabeth, the British monarchy. Why don't you tell my listeners why I was mentioning that stuff, why that's relevant?
Well, it's hard to pinpoint the exact moment, but for many decades, the Queen Elizabeth has been a frequent target of the LaRouche organization, in that they and he have claimed over the years that she is the world's premier drug pusher, that the London British financial system, at her direction, they have financed the spread of drugs throughout the world. They published something, a book in the 80s called Dope Incorporated, where they laid all this out in great detail. One of the early editions actually featured an excerpt from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. That is a tie-in. There are many that claim that when he talks about the British, he's talking about the Jews. And so that is a controversial. I can't claim to know that, but it's rather suspicious once you really deep dive in and see what he says. But the Queen is basically a placeholder for the British Empire, as he called them, to this day. They are the British Empire. They control, they are the ones who are currently acting against President Trump. And trying to have, all the Russia investigations are a coup d'etat against the president. That's where they're at now. But in the 80s, it was, the Queen is a drug pusher. That was just kind of their tagline.
Now, the LaRouche movement are Trump supporters.
Yes. They act as though they are. They have, I think, cynically done that. Because they think there's a niche for them, with the ad w now that Alex Jones is a household name, and there's so much of this sort of right-wing propaganda, they're just kind of another fish in the tank. They're not so special anymore. They've kind of painted themselves in the corner, in my opinion. But before the election, when they were basically saying a pox on both of their houses, and they actually recorded a song. They're big into music, classical music only, and they recorded a song with one of their choruses called "Don't Be a Chump for Trump," and the lyrics were such as, "He's a flaming pustule on Satan's rump. Don't be a chump for Trump." you can't find that today in their official websites because they've scrubbed it, but people have downloaded it and uploaded it elsewhere, so you can find it now.
So they were anti-Trump before they realized, like most right-wingers, that there's a grift here that they can take part in and actually benefit from being Trump fans.
Exactly.
You know, it really is amazing to see everything come full circle. Even going as far back as Lyndon LaRouche, which we should actually even jump that far back. Now on this show, Doomed, I cover a lot of conspiracy theories, right-wing grifts, all that fun stuff, weird internet, and, you know...
This is all of that.
It is all of that, exactly. Exactly. And it's so amazing to see, like, even, like, these older... Because, like, listen, I bet I'm even... Not like I know who LaRouche is because I've come across his supporters from when I first got into politics when I was in high school in the early to mid 2000s. You know, I saw their anti-Bush pamphlets and stuff. I saw their Obama Hitler mustache all the time. In fact, when I was working at Sam Cedar's Majority Port, one day, there was a LaRouche table literally set up across the street from the building we worked in, where the show was broadcast from, around the corner from the New York Times building in Midtown Manhattan. And they were just in the middle, like there was no event going on, no protests, no sort of political happening. I don't think they knew Sam Cedar was there, so I don't think, you know, they were doing it because there was a sort of, you know, well-known leftist some working somewhere in the vicinity. They just happened to put out a table with the Hitler, with the Obama with the Hitler mustache poster. It was just so random. I've seen them all over the place. But still, when it comes to, like, you know, a lot of these conspiracy theorists, at least for as long as I've been it, Lyndon LaRouche, instead of, you know, his career propelling as I got more and more into this stuff, he was already on his way sort of out of it. So to sort of, and I think that's where a lot of my listeners are, so to sort of, I guess, square them up with who Lyndon LaRouche is, let's go all the way back and tell me from the very beginning, who is Lyndon LaRouche? How did he get involved in any of this? How did he build up a movement? How did he even become this political figure that he became?
Wow, where to begin? So just like with people like L. Ron Hubbard, the leader, former leader of Scientology, there's a pretty wide gap between the origin story that the group will tell you versus what actually occurred, and what, you know, the details are pretty sketchy pre-1960s. But so I'll just sort of act as if I'm a LaRouche follower and tell you his origin story and kind of maybe debunk it along the way. But so he was born in the 20s. I think grew up in New Hampshire. His family was from Quaker roots. You can hear it in his voice. He has this sort of what I associate as a more upper class North New England accent. They love to tell the stories about when he was in high school. He talked about a lot of when I was in high school, they tried to teach me about geometry, and I told my teacher that they were full of it. And, basically no school could hold me. He went to Northeastern University and he dropped out twice. He was drafted into World War II and was a conscientious objector based on his Quaker beliefs, until he finally, against his mother's wishes, served in World War II in Burma, I believe. They tell you that while there in Burma, he loves to tell the story. Loved. Thank you. I'm speaking about him in the past tense now. loved to talk about how when he was stationed there and he saw the true face of the British Empire in Burma and India, and that's where he was when Franklin Roosevelt died, and that was the advent of his political life. He knew that Roosevelt was dead, so the peace was no longer secured, and Truman was coming in and was a complete British toady and was going to plunge the world into World War III and extermination. And what actually is known is that he served in Burma, and that's it.
Right.
You know, there's no great awakening there. He worked.
You know, from the sounds of it, not to interrupt you, please remember where you are. But from the sounds of it, and from what I was reading about him, because I honestly was very unfamiliar with his earlier life, it seems like he could have been considered a leftist back when in his youth. From a lot of this, I'm hearing.
Once we get to the '60s, I'll get there. But after the war, he came back home and worked, I believe, in his father's business. They describe him as a management consultant for businesses, and that he was making himself as an economist. But he never finished college. He's not a scholar. His father owned a shoe company. He may have actually been a shoe salesman. You know, we don't know. I'm not sure who knows that. But he, through the 50s, toiled away at that, dabbled in writing in some local newspapers, from what I understand. And then in the 60s, we get to he's in New York. He's in at Columbia University. Or what was called the Free University of New York, I think. And he starts basically just hanging out at colleges and attracting a following of young students who are taking part in what was the Columbia student protests that I think surrounding the Vietnam War was happening. So he was like on the lawns with a bunch of people and talking and attracting followers that way. He was being called Lynn Marcus. He was calling himself Lynn Marcus. He was a Marxist. He described himself as a Trotskyist. He was part of a maybe a legitimate communist grouping for a little while until he sort of solidified his power there was a sort of schism in that group, and out of that grew what was called the National Committee of the National Caucus of Labor Committees, and that is the moment when it goes from a Marxist endeavor to a sort of quasi left wing personality cult. And you can, you know, I like to point people to the resignation letters from that time period of people who left, leaders who left the organization, and what they said about him and his tactics. There was in 1973, he started talking about these other communist groups that are out there, and there was a thing called Operation Mop Up, where they would actually infiltrate other groups that they saw as competitors and get into street fights with them, the legend has it that they would go in places armed with nunchucks. I have found newspaper clippings and pictures of people supposedly who have been, you know, run into these people. That was his, out of that grew what was called the Labor Party, which brought him through the late 70s into the 80s, I think his first run for president was in 1976. He was pretty obscure at that point, but now he had dropped Lynn Marcus and was Lyndon H. LaRouche Jr. again.
Is there any reason why he reverted back and forth in this way? What was his reasoning for even changing his?
Well, he sort of rebranded himself as a down home all American boy, and
LaRouche.
I think wanted to just distance himself from being associated with communism.
Right. So would you say that was his? You know, I guess if this time in Lyndon LaRouche's life happened in, I don't know, sometime between 2015 and present day, he would have made. Would you say this was the moment where he would have jumped on YouTube and filmed the video saying that this was his red pill moment?
Possibly. And that time is also when he's forming alliances with a man named Willis Cardo. If anybody's familiar with him, he ran what was called the Institute for Historical Review, one of the premier Holocaust denial organizations of that time. And he's a main fit. There may have been one meeting between him and LaRouche, but that's when you see in their publications anti-Semitism and racism really coming into being in a very open way.
Right. It's weird to square. I mean, I guess not really weird, but it's a big jump when you hear about his, you know, that first half of his life you told me about to where it's going. There's a quite a disconnect, and I guess it's not too far off actually from a lot of the people we saw that went from being, you know, weirdly, you know, like anti-Republican sort of, you know, some of them I always questioned how on the left they were, who all of a sudden, you know, during the 2016 presidential election just became rabid Trump supporters.
Yeah. Well, for him, I would say this jump was largely a personal challenge that he went through. I think in the 70s he was living in New York with his then wife Janice Neuberger, who they had a son. I'm sorry, he was married to her until they divorced in 1963. I'm reading things wrong, but he was seeing one of his followers named Carol White in the 70s, and she was putting him up in her apartment, legend has it, and he was just, you know, a philosopher king living off of her, and she left him for Christopher White. They later married. Christopher White was another LaRouche follower, and he was British. So that it just so happens that was around the time that the British Empire became a thing. So there are those that say that this was what made him really jump from left to right.
This was his family court moment.
Yeah, exactly. And Christopher and Carol White this was 1973, and this is the beginning of the brainwashing period, where he was having people confess to him, and, you know, Christopher White was supposedly subjected to pretty hardcore interrogation about how he was a spy coming in to destroy the organization, and this was the beginning. And people started leaving around that time. He wrote a piece called Beyond Psychoanalysis, where he kind of laid out his theory about how you brainwash someone. So 1973, I would say, is the moment, is his red pill moment.
So he's one of those guys who something happened to him in his personal life, and it changed his ideological beliefs, as opposed to someone who is, who saw a grift and jumped on it.
Based on the facts in front of us, I think it's fair to wonder if that's true. Yes.
Right.
I try and be careful about what I know and what is hearsay. But
right, because, you know, listen, I gotta say, when I This is the first, this episode is the first time on this topic is the first time I actually had to go outside of names and people I knew and actually put out a call saying, hey, I want to do an episode on Lyndon LaRouche. Does anyone know anyone out there? And I did come across a few experts, one who I had heard of before, but some of these, a lot of these Lyndon LaRouche experts actually are close in age to him and sort of hard to get a hold of, actually.
Sure, yeah.
And
no, go ahead.
Yeah, and so you had contacted me, and you know, we talked for a very little bit. But you know, this just your way of coming at it to me was so interesting because yes, someone could be fascinated by LaRouche and his movement, and also I could hear from someone who actually, and this would be a fascinating episode on its own, someone who actually left the movement. But again, that's sort of there's things I think they would forgive because you know they're probably still coming out of it. Who knows how long ago that was. Whereas you, I think, you know, what fascinated me about what when you told me what your sort of awakening to who LaRouche is that, you know, you are someone who looked into him as if you were looking into him as you were one of these experts trying to write a book about him or something. But you were doing it because you had a family member who had fallen into this. And I think that sort of gives it a more sort of, you know, we're really getting here, I think. We're going to get to, I think. And you sent me some great video clips I'm going to play in a little bit. But I think we're going to get to here, and we already did a little bit with how this sort of is just all full circle. Just how LaRouche has sort of, and we could go into more of his beliefs too, and definitely the movement that grew. But how LaRouche sort of was, if not the godfather, one of the godfathers of sort of the modern day conspiracy theorist movements.
Yeah, it's I'm obviously biased, and you know, back in 2009 when I first became aware of him, one of the only people who was interviewing outside of the group was Alex Jones, and he was not such a household name back then, but now he is, and once the Trump campaign got away in earnest and Alex Jones sort of became a household name, I felt like the world was catching up to me in an eerie way.
Right. Know? This was back when, you know, Alex Jones, you could watch Alex Jones and hear him talk about, you know, aliens or how the government is spying on your brain through cell phone towers or something like that. And you could listen and laugh without knowing that his followers are also harassing the parents of young children who were murdered in a school shooting.
Right. Exactly.
Like, you could watch Alex Jones then and simply enjoy the ridiculousness of Alex Jones.
Yes, and there is a sort of, you know, what you said before about ex-members speaking, I think, especially with groups like this, and I have had contact with a few ex-members. You know, a lot of these people, I feel like I could understand this man and this group has taken 10, 20, 30, you know, who knows how many years of my life. I need to leave this behind me. You know, I can't spend another minute on this. And I think that's a large part of why a lot of people don't speak out. And it's, you know, just the sheer obscurity of LaRouche. You know, to people who've heard of him, he's a punchline. He's a joke. He's, you know, people just, you know, if they're aware of him, they know that, you know, the meme from The Simpsons, you know. Right.
He was in, actually, when I was looking up some videos to pull, I came across, I think it was like an old SNL sketch from when he was running for president.
Yes, it's sad that Al Franken is our best impersonation of him, given what's happened. But
right, that was Al Franken. Okay.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
Oh man, yeah. But Al Franken's recent problems aside, you know, it's in, you know, he, and we didn't even touch on that. Maybe we could touch on that just a little bit about his sort of his move into the mainstream culture when he was sort of just like this fringe presidential candidate. He ran for what, 8 presidential elections?
I think it's 8. I think the last one was 2004.
Right. It must have been he was getting old and he just couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah, at a certain point it became silly.
And like I said, we'll play those clips in a bit, but from some of the clips you sent me, I think you could also tell there's some deterioration going on there in that guy's whatever mind was there beforehand. You can see him going from at least talking in full complete sentences about his conspiracies to sort of mumbling and not really even getting through a complete sentence with these.
One of them, I think it was the second one that I sent you, that he's more or less completely incoherent, and he's explaining to us what happened on 9/11, like the entire world didn't watch that. You know, he's explaining it blow by blow. You know, I'll let you play it, but
right. Let me pull that one up now. Actually, yeah, that one is. Let's see, and you could tell me because there's something funny here about his recollection of the day. I believe that he just gets completely wrong, and you can tell us in a second. I'm gonna play that clip right now.
You've got to figure out what is the actual science behind the way.
Oh, wait, this is not the clip. There's so many of them.
Sorry.
No, I'm happy you sent all these because these are all really great, actually. Let's just go through them all. Why not, right?
Okay.
And then I'll just, because it'll be easier that way. Let's go through them all. All right, so this first one is the one you sent, the Manhattan Town Hall. And this was weird to me to see people talking with him, and was he even in the room, it looked like?
No, he's like Skyping in. He was still in Virginia at this point, I think. After the 9/11 clip, that was one of the last times, if not the last time, he spoke in public, and from that his wife took him to Germany where he died.
All right, let's play this clip now. He's taking a question from a supporter in the audience over live stream, over like Skype or something.
Yeah.
But I wanted to reference a quote that the bishop who gave the mass in Brooklyn on that Sunday.
Let's fast forward to his actual response there. I don't need to hear her quote.
Funnel couldn't get through. So he got off the truck and put on 60 pounds of equipment and ran to the towers and saved countless lives before losing his own life. And this is an event which draws thousands of Americans. These are people. I mean, we talk to people. Obviously, we talk to first responders. We talk to people who lost their loved ones. We talk to Americans who didn't lose anybody. And I know because I talked to them later and asked them. And they, so this is something which is American. It was a principle which is human. It's Christian. It's American. And it was a principle that you could say was an arc from the concerts to this victory in JASTA, which I would describe as nothing less than a miracle, what you just said.
Well, let me try to clarify a ghost. A ghost which happened when the two towers, collapsed. What happened was it went out from Boston. Boston Airport, the citizens in two concentrations in Boston, and in each turn, each of these things went down, with the passengers, what had been the passengers, turned down, burned down. Huh? This happened. It kept on. It was done by the Saudis themselves. It was done by the consent of the friends of the Saudis at the same time. For a long time, relatively speaking, since that time, that is what happened. I was a witness from a tower, a different tower, and I gave a record of this thing. I observed, in my own eyes, I observed what happened on that day. It's gone. That whole thing has been there since that time. Only recently, in the most recent days, we have finally escaped that horrible experience. Mm-hmm. And we should take pressure and pleasure in the fact that we have finally pulled ourselves together. And we have also thrown the Saudis out of the United States.
All right. They're clapping. And I got to say, first of all, for people who are just listening to the podcast version of this and not getting the visual on YouTube, the first half of everything he said was literally him looking down, reading something, and his bald head literally front and center right in the camera. So everyone on YouTube got a nice treat to see Lyndon LaRouche's scalp. And that was nice and fun. But first of all, he said he saw that what happened on 9/11. And Jay, I believe you have something to say about that.
Well, we all saw what happened on 9/11, and he makes some reference to I was in a different tower or
right,
something like
right, right.
He was in Virginia. He saw it on TV like we all did, or right. like those of us who are lucky did, and that was one of perhaps a dozen times in the last year from like 2015 to 2016 that he was on an interview or a show of theirs of some point doing exactly that, blow by blow explaining what happened on 9/11 for no explicable reason. It's bizarre.
Now, I don't know if I guess I never realized, but apparently we also kicked every Saudi person out of the country at some point.
That was towards the end of Obama's presidency when a bill called JASTA was passed, and it was to declassify the 28 pages that were blacked out in the 9/11 report that supposedly definitively proved that the Saudi government was behind 9/11.
Now, did LaRouche supported this act though, correct?
Yes, but they when it happened, they claimed that they made it happen, you know, and which is their trade. You know, whenever world events align to LaRouche's interests, it's because of him. And when things aren't going right, it's someone else's fault. It's the British. It's my wicked followers who've left me or stolen my money, or, you know, it's the credit he likes to take for anything he sees as. He made JASTA happen.
Now, with all that said, though, I think I might blow this whole LaRouche movement up right now, end it all, by pointing out that they think that Obama is Hitler, but they supported
worse than Hitler.
Excuse me, but but they think that they supported this thing that Obama did. Then I guess the LaRouche people like Hitler.
Well, I think Obama tried to block. I don't know that Obama was involved in that. That was done in the Congress. I'm not sure I'm not sure they played along with that. I'm not sure.
Right. Okay. I get it. Now. Now, it's amazing how I couldn't find that clip when you first brought it up, and then I said, "Oh, let's just play them all." And of course, It's the first one I find when I play it. But right. let's go through them actually, because there's some more. You know, there's some really good stuff here. So that was the Manhattan Town Hall event. Now let's play this LaRouche pack.
If you want to break.
Now this one is interesting. This one is. This one was my favorite, actually, because
that's one of the ones that you can't find on their official channel. You know, there's certain things that he said over the years that they managed to scrub the video, but people managed to find it and clip it. But.
Right. Well, along with what he says here, I also really like the number of times there's awkward silence in literally what it amounts to be a 45-second clip. I did not know you can have like the perfect amount of silence that it's awkward that many times, like separate times though, within a 45 second clip. Everyone will understand what I mean when they hear it right now. I'm going to play it.
If you want to break from that, you've got to figure out, well, what is the actual science behind the way we're meant to behave? And there's a real statement of scientific principle there contained in the preamble.
That was, when, where does the chimpanzee go to vote in the U.S. election?
I think at the White House. No. Anything else?
It does it for me.
Okay. Everything else, Lynn?
No, it's fine.
All right. Well, then we'll go ahead and wrap it up for this week. All right. Thanks a lot for watching, and we'll see you next week.
Now, again, for anyone just listening to the podcast, you had three LaRouche followers sitting together at a table, and they throw it to they're talking, and LaRouche just sort of butts in, and I'm assuming he's talking about Obama. Is that correct, Jay?
Yes. I think you'd be a fool to say otherwise.
Yes, and it is important to point out that there's the three people who are at this table who are LaRouche followers. There's a woman. There is a George R.R. Martin cosplayer, and there is a black man. And LaRouche, from his, I guess at this time he's still in Virginia.
Yes.
And it's more awkward that this guy is leading this movement and all his followers are together and this guy is just this voice in the clouds just butting in from his little office space whenever I guess he feels fit. And they let him, obviously, because he's the leader. And he just says this thing about Obama that really it doesn't make any sense to me. Where do chimpanzees go to vote? Do you know the context and what he even meant by that when he was, I mean, other than the racist part of it?
Well, it's not the first time that he referred to Obama as a chimpanzee or a monkey or an ape. My analysis of that clip, I think I'm stealing this from Dennis King, who wrote a book about LaRouche in the 80s. He's another long time. He might have been one of the people you were talking about before who's hard to get a hold of.
But, right. He's like, he actually is the guy who runs when you like search Lyndon LaRouche on Google. And yeah. LyndonLaRouche.org comes up and you assume, oh, that must be the guy's website. And it's not. It's this guy who's covered him. He runs the website.
Yeah. And I remember reading on his website something I think makes sense, which is the black man you refer to was a leader at that time. He's now out of the organization. It seems like LaRouche, he was a major leader. He was like looking to be maybe a successor to LaRouche at that point. And when someone is, and that beginning of that clip, he's ending some remarks. And when it seems like, especially in the later years, when it seems like his dementia is taking hold and he's sometimes maybe not clear about if he's talking to if these are public remarks, or you know, I'm not sure what his awareness is that he can be heard outside of the group, you know, because they have a lot of internal discussions too, so he might just be thinking he's just talking. But it seems like you know, someone other than me looks a little too smart right now, so I've got to cut him down to size and make a joke about chimpanzees. That's what it looks like to me.
Do you think that was also a, Obama thing, you think that was also in reference to the guy who actually supports him too? Like,
I do think so, yeah.
Yeah, I had that feeling too, and I thought it was very, very weird that he would throw someone who follows him. Like, I mean, I guess it's not when you hear about cult leaders. But,
and not just any member. He was a leader in the group.
Right.
He was a major, yeah.
Right, makes a lot of sense. Now, let's continue on with these clips, because there's... They're really they get more just a sight to behold. I don't even know how else to explain them. Let's get to this fireside chat. Did they do these every week? It seems, or it seems
they still do. They still do. They do one. They did one just yesterday, I think.
Oh, how are they reacting to his death?
How are they reacting? I mean, it's a loss to humanity. We have to work ever harder now to realize his vision for the world, and humanity has suffered a great loss, and if we don't follow what he wanted, then we're all gonna die.
Right, of course. Makes sense. I mean, all right, I'm gonna play this fireside chat, which, by the way, is the YouTube video is titled "The Sputtering British Coup Against Trump." Even though this particular portion I'm gonna play has nothing to do with that, I don't think.
So, but the clip, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
This is I think from yesterday, and they're playing a clip of him from the 70s at this point.
Oh, okay, got it. Right. All right.
It's like, yeah.
That's this one. Okay, got it. Cool. I'm playing it right now.
Idea of new economic platforms. This is an example from July of 1978.
Right. They're introducing the clip now.
Bush put forward of this type.
So very serious proposal, clip? I'm sure. Here we go.
Craters.
Excuse me, Dennis, do you want to play the Newplexes 2?
That's Newplexes 1. Oh,
they're having the same issues I had where they were playing the wrong clip. Good to know that I share that with the LaRouches.
We're going
to
build Newplex. Let's lay it out to them. How do you build a Newplex? You go out and you dig a big crater. You lay a big footing, unless you've got bedrock, which even that. You don't even care what the terrain is like. Makes no difference. Wherever you are, blast it out, build a crater. Build a crater covering an area the size of a city. A city of 500,000 people or 100,000 people. But build a crater for an industrial city of a new type on an area of that size. All right, 6, 7, 8 stories below the surface. Build it up. Build up to the surface. On this thing, stick 2 nuclear plants. 0.5 gigawatt to 2 gigawatts each. You get a balanced load. String industries around this, using this energy to cut low distribution costs. Like charm bracelets. Well, let's put a chemical industry here. That's the good thing. Let's have desalination here, so forth. Using the waste heat and the electrical power. Build housing for the families. Modern housing. Housing to last 100 years. For the families of the people who are going to be brought in to do the construction, which will be done, completed within a period of 4 to 6 years. Build the on-site cultural ed program. Schools, universities, technical schools. Everything that a city requires. And when the project is completed, at the end of 6 years, these people occupy the factories because they've been educated. And gradually the Europeans and others who have been phased in, phase out, except for a few key technicians. The city then is built.
Except for a few key technicians.
You can change it. You can develop it with no big cost. Its transportation systems are built in. And modular for the next 100 years for any technological improvements which would be significant in the next 100 years. The city functions. City built. Now, 4 to 6 years. We're going to build hundreds of these in the next 25 years. Hundreds of them. Hundreds of new cities throughout the world, especially in the developing sector. These cities will be linked together. They will form a network of high technology culture, planted in the middle of the other rest of the population. And from these cities and through these cities and their universities and technical schools and technical services to the surrounding area, we'll lift one generation of the human race from barbarism and oppression into modern life. And it would, in the next 25 years following that, we'll complete the job. And within 50 years from now, the human race will be transformed as we city builders intend to do it. We are going to mobilize every industry that exists that's viable and everyone that can be created to do this. We're not going to export a few $10-20 billion worth of additional exports. We're going to export hundreds of cities.
That vision.
Now, Jay,
Yes.
I guess we could. He could have updated the that saying socialism or barbarism. He could have LaRouche or barbarism. That's what it sounded like to me. But his vision was very influential to how we live today. As you all know, those hundreds and hundreds of cities were built, and we are all living that life today. He was a visionary.
Yeah, and I think this is just one of the reasons that people like to attach the word fascism to him, because it sounds to me, when I listen to that, I think you're going to need a lot of slave labor to do that. I think you're going to have to actually force people to do that. You know, like he, that sounds weird to me.
Right.
That you think that's possible, but right. I'm just a lay person. What do right. I know?
That is really the if you were listening to that and you had to come up with something to say about it, I mean, that really was perfect, because I honestly had no other way to respond to that. It's just so out there. And, you know, you need a lot of people to dig a lot. That's true. Right.
Yeah.
And
just blow lots of holes in the earth. Just build the cities. Yeah. Okay.
Right. Right. And
it's easy.
Right. And now you sent me one more clip that I have to play. Because this is another older clip of him. And I have to say, though, while listening to this clip, I hate to say it, this guy could have got a gig on MSNBC today.
Oh, yeah? Is it the Russia one?
Yeah. Let me play.
Who's saying that on MSNBC?
Not quite that, but, you know.
Oh, dear.
You get a lot of – the Red Scare thing is big among centrist liberals right now.
I guess
it's yeah, this whole Trump thing has turned people really xenophobic against the Russians and that whole section of the world. But let's play it, because this is even a step, obviously this is steps way too far.
Well, the modern day LaRouche was saying that he was a great friend of the Russians, and that Putin loves him, and that they had so much sway in Russian, you know, they're complete Putin apologists, you know. But anyway,
here we go.
Take the Russian out of Russia, out of Holy Moscow, out of Matuska Rus, out of Rodna, and you bring that Russian into Western civilization, assimilate him in Western civilization. Not, of course, in the Shikaria in Hamburg, but, I mean, real civilization. This Russian, as we know from Russian immigrants into Western Europe and the United States, this Russian is just like the rest of us, essentially. Most of the time. But he becomes a productive worker, very skilled, moral, as we are moral. But you take his relative back in Russia, in Great Russia, and what have you got? You have a lazy, drunken, superstitious, immoral beast. That's a typical Russian. The Russian hates technological progress. The Russian hates that sort of thing. There are few Russians that can produce. Well, they have a military dictatorship, so they take all the productive Russians and they put them in the military sector. And they all the dumb Russians who can't behave, who can't do anything, they put them in the civilian economy. And they make the civilian economy work by using slave labor from Turks and others, or by slaving and looting Eastern Europe. We in the West have actually twice to three times the productivity per person of the Russians. Because we can assimilate and enjoy assimilating technological progress. We generate it and assimilate it. Russians can produce scientists, but they can't make their civilian economy work. Because the scientists cannot get the idea assimilated and accepted by the public.
Now, I don't even know what to say about this. I just think it's interesting to see where he's, you know, we didn't put them in order, but to see the progression of, you know, just how terrible the stuff he was saying back then was. But, you know, like we were just talking about before, the deterioration in this guy throughout the years, and how he was still able to maintain this foothold, though, in so many people's minds with this movement of his, it's stunning to me. It's, you know, I don't see how you listen to that clip and you're like, even back then, and you're taken by this guy. And then to fast forward to today and hear his mumblings of 9/11, and that, like, that crowd that was listening to him clapping after that regurgitation of garbage. I just don't get it. And you know, I don't want to spend too much more time on Lyndon LaRouche, the guy, because I do want to talk a little bit more about the movement and where it goes from here, and, you know, your personal experience with that. But, you know, I guess we could take it to, you know, so he was against Bush. He hated Obama. Do you have a sense of who he disliked more?
Between the two?
Yeah.
I mean, when Obama first came on the scene, he was saying he had potential. Maybe he was the next FDR. And when he took office, he was saying, we must protect the president because he's under great threat of assassination. But then shortly thereafter, once the Affordable Care Act became part of the debate, he started saying this was the beginning of what, you know, he compared it to the T4 Hitler program that started the Holocaust. So, and this was, yeah.
What was it about Obama that he liked? Like, I really, honestly, Lyndon LaRouche is so confusing to me on, like, where he is on the ideological spectrum. Like, clearly his movement is a right-wing movement, but
I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, please go ahead.
I again compare him to L. Ron Hubbard, and the question often asked of people like this, these cult leaders, do they believe their own bullshit or not? Are they willfully, LaRouche is so all over the map that it's hard to put him on the political spectrum. He's all over the map. I think most of the time he's just kind of winging it saying and doing what will, you know, it's very rarely for public consumption because he's speaking to the already converted.
What are people like? Listen, you show me like a serial killer with a fan base. You show me like a Charles Manson documentary or something. Like, as crazy as those people are and how horrible, you know, those people are terrible people, obviously. But you see sort of what attracted people with weak minds to them. Whereas this guy, I can't pinpoint what it is exactly that sort of brings people to him. I don't find him charismatic. I don't find him sort of compelling. It's like I find what he says to be crazy, but it's not crazy in a way that makes me think he's smart. It's like, maybe that's it. Maybe I'm just not getting it in terms of that aspect. Maybe that's the thing that gets people.
Well, my thing is, I think charisma is something that's pretty subjective, and you know, one person's charisma is another's. However, we see Lyndon LaRouche, I think this sort of leads into me talking about the group where it really, in my opinion, depends on where you are in your life when you're introduced to it and how you're introduced to it, and you know, they don't give you all the crazy at once.
Right, right.
They're very controlled about what they introduce you to and when.
Right. And sort of my, you know, I'm discussing here to sort of get, you know, to sort of throw some things out there and see exactly, you know, because you're bringing up points that I did not think of before. But my assumption with the Obama thing, my personal opinion is that, you know, he's jumped back and forth because this is a guy who was following the grift in some cases at this point. Like we see with their current, the movement's current, really embracing Trump, you know, back before the ACA, I guess, it was cool to like Obama across the board. He was going to be the guy who saves us from Bush. And then I guess once the ACA, once the ACA comes into effect, there was enough on the right to sort of jump to that side of things.
The issue is also, you know, they had a big recruitment drive around the Iraq War when that happened. That was the beginning of what became called the LaRouche Youth Movement, where a lot of leaders were recruited. They're not so young anymore, and many have left. But what was I going to say? I think his brand, ultimately what LaRouche's brand is he's, you know, the saying, a stopped clock is right twice a day. His whole thing is the economy's collapsing. Everything's going to fall apart any minute now. And you have to do what I say or else, or we're all going to die and there's going to be thermonuclear war. So you don't get anywhere by supporting the president. You know, it was literally a few months there. He was, you know, kind of skeptically praising Obama. And then the full, you know, once, like you said, once the ACA came in, it was full Hitler. But, he's always got to have something to point to say the world is falling apart.
Right.
Right now.
And now he's dead.
And now he's dead.
So do we know how he died? Was it, you know, MI, whatever they are. What is it again? Now I'm having a mental block. MI5, is that who they are? Yeah, right? Right? I think so. Right?
Well, it'd be in Germany, so I think that'd be MI6.
Oh, okay.
If I'm right.
Okay, so... Or maybe the Queen went out there and got up on a building, you know, top of a building and took him out herself.
It's hard to say. They haven't said. But I imagine it was something related to... There's people saying that he was showing signs of dementia as early as 2006. So this was a long process. You know, some along the way he was coherent enough to get things going, but yeah, you can see the deterioration pretty clearly in those later clips that he just needed to be sort of disappeared, and he hadn't been heard from for almost 3 years at this point. Until Tuesday, when the rumors broke on Twitter, I think because ex-members started getting word, but they weren't, you know, talking to the press until the next day. But I imagine it was, you know, he was 96. It was something.
Right. Now, I remember that. I remember that. It just happened a couple of days ago. But I heard, yeah, like it was 2 days ago that the news broke that he died, but then no one really covered it. And then everyone sort of thought that, oh, false flag, you know?
Right. I mean, that whole day they could have put that to bed and said he's still alive, and they didn't. So it was pretty clear to me, I think, that he was gone.
Now, in those 3 years where he basically disappeared, how were they, you know, were there people who thought maybe he was already dead and they didn't know about it? Like, how were they continuing with this? How was the move, his followers going on?
That was what I was afraid of for a long time. Did he die 2 years ago and they're just saying that he's still there? But it's his wife who's largely running things now by appearances, who he was one of his supporters. They got married in the 70s after that whole debacle that I explained before about Chris and Carol White. Her name is Helga Zepp LaRouche. Hyphened Zepp LaRouche, and she has a sort of tenuous grasp on things now. We'll see where it goes, but I think they were kind of cultivating among the supporters that even if he can't be the public face anymore, he's still somewhere in the background reading the newspaper and guiding things. You know, I think it was just that.
Now, when your sibling, when you find out that your sibling is in this movement, you know, you said it much earlier in the show that, you know, you looked into why your sibling was changing so much, and you know, you determined that, you know, I get when you come across the LaRouche propaganda, the pamphlets and stuff.
Yeah.
So what goes on there? So clearly from there you jump into this, you learn as much as you can about this, which is why you're helping guide us through the world of Lyndon LaRouche today. Now, when have you last heard from your sibling? Roughly, if you don't want to give out the,
I have to, be careful about what I say, but right.
Has it been a long time, like a few years, or you just say like they only give an exact?
They're still in contact with other members of my family, but not with me directly for quite some time.
Right, and it's because your sibling knew that you were.
Yes, learning I showed my hand way too soon. In that regard, one thing I should say is, you know, I've used the word cult a few times, that we've used the word cult a few times. And when a cult comes to your door, you find that the word cult is not a very useful word, in describing these things. I always quote my therapist, and that's what I recommend to anybody who's come into contact with this organization, is to get a therapist right away. But my therapist says there's a very good reason why the word cult is contained in the word culture. And I started using that word a little too soon, and many experts, the few there are in these things, will tell you that you shouldn't be using that word and talking too much about the group and things, and maybe trying to connect with the person on a more emotional level. And I was not equipped to do that in my panic, and I was kind of the only one in my family who was raising the alarm about this. And
I got to be honest with you. You're like, if I came across this stuff for a family member of mine, I probably would have been in. I may have disregarded it too at first. And this is coming from someone who reads about a lot of this stuff, because to me, you know, just from the LaRouche stuff that I've seen, you know, that they hand out and spread, you know, before they hit you over the head with the big picture stuff, it does just seem sort of like, you know, not too far out, but, you know, maybe like a little bit fringy political stuff. You know, not too crazy where I'd be concerned quite yet. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, and I think the things that alarmed me the most when I looked into it was reading about the trials, reading the trial transcripts, reading his statement on sentencing where he compares himself to Jesus Christ and expresses no remorse, and there's no acknowledgement for, there, you know, there's plenty of information out there about the fraud trials, in the late 80s, all throughout the 80s, really, prosecuted by, a little known federal prosecutor named Robert Mueller.
It's amazing how this all comes. And he was friends with Roger Stone too.
Roger Stone has been at one of the front groups is called the Schiller Institute. Schiller as in Friedrich Schiller, the German philosopher. He was speaking at a conference for the Schiller Institute as early as late last year, when it was looking pretty dire for him. And he was like pretty clearly trying to troll them for money and, asking for people to make donations to his legal fund.
And to really bring it all together, this I just found out while researching this week. When Russia was looking into spreading misinformation during the 2016 campaign, they reached out to the LaRouche movement.
Yes, that's in the Steele dossier, I think.
Right. That was mind-blowing to me that, because at this point in 2016, LaRouche folks are sort of, obviously to people who have family members in the movement, this isn't the case, but to the mainstream public and even the political wonks, you know, LaRouche is out of everyone's vision at this point, pretty much.
Yeah.
Really incredible.
Yeah, you said it. I'm not sure I have much to add.
Right. So let's get back to, you know, your experience here. So you show your hand. I guess you approached him, your sibling.
Yes.
I guess if this was today, you would say something like, are you a stan for Lyndon LaRouche?
Yeah, we didn't have that language back then, but
are you a LaRouche stan? I mean, I guess that would have been helpful then, you know?
Yeah, I could be more specific and maybe make it a little clearer, but I have to be careful and just say that I reacted with anger where I should have been more more understanding and just projecting concern more than anything else. And by the time I was asking him more calmly to look at the critical information that's out there, he was already pretty far gone,
right?
Into it, and yeah, it's
now I'm totally not bringing this up to, like, you know, if I was in your shoes, it would have been the same. Once I realized where this was going, same reaction. So I don't want you to, like, you know, feel like you really it's you had the reaction that I think 99.9% of people would have.
Well, but I appreciate that.
But where I'm headed with this is, because, like, there's a reason why, for people who are watching on YouTube right now, you know, usually I do the split screen with a guest unless, you know, there's reasons why they can't. And, you know, the LaRouche movement, I'm guessing your sibling told them, or they found out somehow that you were, you were out there trying to tell people that LaRouche was no good.
Yes, there's over the years been a number of, like, message boards where ex-members will congregate and wring their hands about what's going on in LaRouche world. And I was on that after my sibling moved and overexposed myself a little bit. They had a few trolls lurking in there to antagonize people, and I sort of would, in my anger, engage with them, and I overexposed myself a little bit and got into some trouble. But
now, when you say, did they come at, like, you know, you hear these things about other I don't know if I should put all these people or these groups in this category, but I think I feel good doing it. You know, Scientologists, you know, people who, I think you could go as far as saying, you know, people who follow, who were into, I don't know, cults like Jonestown. You know, you hear these stories about these groups, no matter how they try to portray themselves in public. When they find out that there's someone who's getting a little bit too on the inside and knows a little bit too much, they suddenly become that whole goody two shoes facade goes right out the window.
It's true. And I didn't get it too bad. I was doxxed. They were monitoring my Twitter account and posting things to say certain things that might damage my credibility, depending, you know, I retweeted something and they put it on their website and connected me to this is who is posting on this website under this name on FactNet, it was called back then. That's now no longer, it was sort of a message board, leaning towards cults and I just kind of overexposed myself without thinking about it, enough. I didn't get it too bad. But since then, I contacted you through, like, a dummy Twitter account, you know, that I had.
Right.
That
right. And I felt bad, you know, I'm not going to give anything away, but, you know, I asked you a little bit about yourself just so I could confirm, because who knows, you know, like, the past couple of episodes, I mean, right-wingers have always been following me on Twitter and stuff, but the past couple of episodes especially had some trolls from that alt-right social network, Gab, watching the show, so I had to be careful I wasn't being fooled into having someone on who ended up not being the LaRouche expert I thought they were.
Yeah, if you had called that first number that was left on your original message, that you would have been talking to one of those people. He was Paul Glumas, I think is his name.
Right.
But anyway,
you saw that. Yeah, they were recommending me. I saw someone recommended me, and I looked the guy up, obviously. And the guy, he's a LaRouche guy, right? Like, he's a follower of LaRouche. Yeah.
Yeah. Long time.
I mean, I did say I'm interested in talking to a follower, but I think, you know, I was interested.
Oh, I'm fascinated what you could get from him, but.
Yeah, maybe I will do it. Yeah. I mean, I've been actually, since the new year, I mean, last year I had on like a right winger or two. I've already had on one this year. I'm on a crusade to have as many, you know, I'm a leftist. I usually have leftists on the show to talk about the right and to even talk about, you know, leftist policy and ideology and stuff like that. But I'm on this like newfound, you know, mission to get more right wingers, more people who don't think or agree with me on this show, because I just have so much fun talking with them. But I think I'll do it. I mean, why not? But let's get back to, I think what I want to sort of end here with is, and I could go on with you about this stuff forever because this is so fascinating, is do you think the Queen is safe now that LaRouche is gone? And no, but really, what do you think? Have you seen basically anything about where the movement goes actually? Like, I know we briefly talked about before what their reaction was to LaRouche being dead and this being the end of the world. But, you know, you said his wife is sort of taking a hold of everything going on now. Do you know sort of what the outlook is for these folks? And do you think, you know, like, what do you think is going to happen to your sibling? Like, does this movement grow and your sibling has more people who are with it, him or your sibling? Or do you think that, you know, your sibling ends up being one of these, you know, stragglers or hanger-ons on this dead movement and he's just, you know, alone in this world?
Well, it's a scary thing, and I managed to contact the person who recruited my sibling, who is out now, who explained a lot to me about how this all worked and how it works in general when people are being recruited. And it's a scary thing because there, like you said, there are so many older members who they've, some of them have been in since the 70s, and they are completely isolated from their former life. They have nowhere to go. If the, you know, it's,
I mean,
it's,
even the most recent, like, big LaRouche pushes in, you know, in the mainstream, the things that would have actually brought in new members, we're talking at the earliest about a decade back now.
Yes, and they can't, you know, like I said before, with they're trying to support Trump and saying that Trump is okay, but he just has to adopt LaRouche's plan, and then it'll be fine. But in general, like I said before, they're just another fish in the alt-right pond now, and I think, you know, we'll see where things go, but I think things deteriorate more. There's people, there's recent ex-members saying that there's been a lot of people who have been waiting for this moment for LaRouche to die to make their exit, and they've been planning to get out. They've been sending, as their numbers dwindle more and more, they've been, a lot of the, you know, people still there are being sent out to get jobs, and I can't prove this, but it's my fear that these people are being sent out to get jobs so that they can be giving a tithe basically to the movement and keep things going for however much longer she, Helga, feels it will go. But it could go a lot of ways. There could be purges. She's in Germany and doesn't have probably a firm hand on all of the factions that might be developing now, and we could see a struggle for leadership, for someone might want to take up the mantle for themselves, or, you know, I'm not sure what position she's in, if she can be challenged, or, you know, if we say that LaRouche was at all charismatic, she doesn't have what he had. Like, she's not a very engaging speaker. You won't catch her saying the wacky things that he says. She's pretty straight ahead, like, still in that ideology, but she's not flying off the cuff like LaRouche was in the last 15 years. I don't think she's going to have that working in her favor. I can't pretend to know what it looks like on the ground right now, but it's pretty dire, and the disadvantage that they have is that they're a registered political action committee and they have to report their finances to the FEC. And when you go on the FEC website and look at their financial reports for all the election cycles, the numbers are going down, and they're going down and down and down, and right. the debts are rising, and you can see that they don't. And I'm just a layperson, but they don't behave like other political action committees do. They're not giving money to candidates. They occasionally will run candidates, but they'll give them token amounts of $500 to $1,000 when the total income is in the millions. And so, you know,
they're still pulling in millions of dollars.
The latest report is I think it's over a million.
But going down though, right?
It's going down consistently, and you can look at their expenditures, and all of the expenditures go to this for-profit company called the LaRouche Policy Institute, LLC. And my understanding, again, I'm just a layperson, but my understanding is that Freedom of Information Act requests are a bit easier to make now that he's gone. And this is my personal opinion, but if there would be anybody listening who would be interested or has the power to make a Freedom of Information Act request for either the Schiller Institute or the LaRouche Policy Institute LLC. I don't know if that's possible, but if it is, it's my belief, my very biased belief, that you will find crimes in there.
Wow. What, do you know what kind of crimes?
Fraud.
Oh, just okay. I was hoping maybe, you know.
So when people talk about campaign finance reform, this is what I would like. There was a pretty interesting article.
I was thinking maybe some collusion crime, some sort of.
Who knows?
Right.
But I'm pretty sure that, LaRouche being a felon himself, and many of his underlings who are still in control of the organization being felons, I am pretty suspicious that this is all in the up and up now. And
so it sounds like he LaRouche took picked a good time to say peace.
could be. I'm not sure.
Now I just want to end it with this. We received a comment in the YouTube chat from listener Grimlock, who said my dumbass stepfather donated to him because he thought he was actually labor. I had to explain to him to get that shit the fuck out of our house. So I hope Lyndon is burning in hell.
Well, it's uncomfortable for me to endorse that kind of language, but I am anonymous here, but there's a chance that someone could recognize my voice. But,
right. So I get it, Jay.
I heard that comment.
Jay, thank you really so much for joining us today and sharing your, really, it's a personal story, and it's not, it's not easy to tell, I'm sure. And I think you, not only the personal story, but you've immersed yourself into learning about this guy. And, if your sibling somehow comes across this, clip at this interview and listens, I just want to say that it should be just clear from everything you told me today that you care so much about this person, and they should at the very least contact you and just give you an update about how everything's going.
I really appreciate that. And if I could just spend one more minute saying something.
Sure.
There's a woman named Erica Duggan. She is British. Her son was a young student, 22 years old, who was studying abroad in France, made his way during, you know, it was in the height of this early 2000s when the Iraq War was happening. He ended up in Germany at a Schiller Institute conference. You can go to justiceforjeremiah.com to find out what happened to him. But long story short, he ended up dead on the side of a highway. There's accounts that I probably shouldn't go that deep into it, but they're still trying to find out what happened to their son. And I heard Erica Duggan speaking about this to the British press when an inquest was going on. And I heard her say that something to the effect of the only reason that I can speak about this group is because my son is gone, and that there are lots and lots of people. It's hard to quantify at this point, but there are lots and lots of people who are worried, concerned, and frightened for someone they know in this group. And they must suffer in silence, because if they speak out, they will alienate the person they're trying to save. And if I could just address her directly and say, Miss Duggan, I heard you. I thank you. And your words have carried me to this day where I feel more comfortable speaking, because while I may be taking a risk in doing this, I think they have bigger problems than me at this point.
Jay, really, I thank you so much for joining us on the show today. I can't thank you enough. And, you know, if I ever need to jump into this world again, I know exactly who to talk to. It's one that I think is really undercovered, even when it was sort of in everyone's sort of daily news cycle, when they would see these people out on the street with their you know, pamphlets and their Obama Hitler mustache signs. You know, they were always, you know, if this was happening nowadays, in the same time as the alt-right, you know, and there's a lot of, you know, mirror image here going on between the two groups in many ways, you know, would they be undercovered? And I just don't know. Maybe the LaRouche movement just happened to slip by just being where they were at that place and time.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to add to that, but
Jay, take care. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you, Matt.
All right, everybody. To support this show, go to patreon.com/Matt Binder. That's patreon.com/Matt Binder. Could really use some new Patreon subscribers. Like I said in the last episode, there was some sort of issue with Patreon. Some people who their processing declined for some reason, were able to fix it because of whatever was going on with Patreon's payment processor. But we did lose a few people because of that issue. And of course, obviously, we always want to gain people every episode if possible. Patreon.com/Matt Binder. You will get... first of all, you support this show happening every week, just in general. I can't do this without the support. You also will get the audio file of the patron-only part of the show, which I will be going into right after I finish these promos. You could also support this show by going to iTunes, typing in Doomed, Google Play, typing in Doomed, and leave a review. 5-star review, written review. We're at on iTunes. I haven't checked the other various platforms, but on iTunes, we got over, you know, 100 reviews easily. But let's go to 200 next. And what else do I want to say? Oh, doomed.tv will take you to the YouTube channel. Please subscribe to the YouTube channel. I'd really like to grow this YouTube channel, but I'd like to do more with the YouTube channel because the YouTube channel allows me to really, you know, with the podcast, I like to do a full episode, you know, that's once a week, a nice guest. But with the YouTube channel, I'd like to grow that so I could do maybe a shorter 1, 2, 3, 4 minute clips throughout the week too. That would be great. Love to do it. Need your support on YouTube, need your support on iTunes and Google Play and with all that. And especially if you can afford to, again, only if you could afford to, your financial support at patreon.com/MattBinder. And to show you how much I appreciate those patrons, I'm going to name them all before we go into the members half of the show. Abigail T, Adam Q, Alan B, Andrew H, Benji A, Bobby M, Brett R, Brian James D, Brooke H, Christine H, Clement C, Colin R, Dank Uger, Dave K, Dragon Slayer 19, Emily M, Fraz K, Francis Z, Ian Curtis J, Jameson Test, Janelle A, JR, Jasmine H, Jeff K, Josh C, Julie, Katie S, Louis from Texas, Marcos R, Max Wanderman, User Me, Michael J, Michael M, Misfit Demit, Mr. Danks, Mugrim, Nicole A, Namdenet, Omid M, Romina O, Cena, the good folks over at Struggle Session. I just realized they became patrons. Thank you so much, guys. TM, Tamney G, Thaddeus A, Tom G, Tom M, Trine E, Will P, and Zarin. Weirdly missing from my patrons is a certain Michael Brooks. Maybe he's having money issues. He's only got, 2,000 patrons, though. Oh, boy. Always love... and I gave... who did I give? Kennedy and... Who else did I give? I gave some people moderator status in the chat today. I hope they... first of all, I don't even know if they were in there moderating. But the chat seemed like it was well put together. So if you guys are in there moderating, thank you. I appreciate that. Talking about the YouTube live chat. And folks, that is the free portion of the Doomed with Matt Binder podcast / YouTube live stream if you're watching on YouTube live via stream. And see you all next time on Doomed.